her hair soaked and her skin clammy, running down like an old cheap clock, with her husband gone and one son miserably dead and the other unable to reach her. In the times when she roused from her doped coma, Bruce sat with her, sometimes reading, though he was sure she didn't listen except to the sound of his voice. But she was altogether better awake than asleep. Her breathing was easier, and far away as she was, her words had sometimes a strange oracular wisdom, a tolerance untouched by personal feeling, as if she had withdrawn far enough not to be moved any more, far enough to see her life as a wry comedy, the world as a goldfish tank in which fishes of all sizes and shapes and colors went after food, made love, nosed with incomprehensible and unimportant compulsions up and down against the glass walls, or lay suspended among the water plants, insulated from watchers by the different element they lived in. "Did you know," she said to Bruce on the second afternoon, "that your dad is keeping another woman?" "No," he said slowly. "I did not." She smiled. "For quite a while now," she said, and made her little face, the lines deepening around her eyes. "He had her in Reno. Now he's got her here."
"How do you know?"
"I can smell her," she said. She shook her head at him slightly. "I shouldn't have told you. You'll take it hard."
The biting edges of his teeth were set precisely together. He felt the little trench along the edge of the incisors, and his mind said accurately and scientifically, "Faulty occlusion." But through his teeth he said aloud, "Why shouldn't I take it hard? Why shouldn't you?"
"I don't," she said. "I don't seem to care. I can't blame him. I haven't been any good as a wife for a long time."
That intimacy outraged him, as he had been outraged during adolescence to see them kissing. He sat very still and said nothing.
"Bruce," she said, and took hold of his fingers, "don't blame him too much. There's something in him that has to have a woman to lean on. He's leaned on me all his life, but he can't now."
"When you get sick," he said, "when you can't take care of his boils and wipe his nose and listen to his troubles, he abandons you and finds some slut—"
"No," she said. She smiled at him wearily,
wiser than he would ever be, not bothered either by her husband's weakness or her son's hatred, not part of it any more, withdrawing, smiling remotely on the pillow with her braids down across her shoulders.
"Don't," she said.
"Oh, my God," he stood up, blinded by the pressure that in a moment would be tears. Abruptly he left her, motioned at Miss Hammond as he went through the living room with averted face, and shut himself in the bathroom. During that day, workmen had installed a neon sign on the front of the apartment house across the street, and with the apartment darkened, the bluish echo of its light lay on the walls. Miss Hammond was lying down, and Bruce stretched out on the Murphy bed, forcing his mind away from the snoring breath in the sick room, forcing himself to think of anything, everything that there was life in. The sensuous shape and texture of the world, the nights and days and hours and moments when the burden was removed and a man was himself and himself only, wrapped in his own bright identity beyond which there was nothing. He thumbed them over like pictures from an old album, discarding these because there was a shadow on them, laying others aside to be looked at more carefully. His mind adjusted itself, refocused, as the eyes adjust to the parallax of a stereopticon lens, and in the timelessness of memory the pictures sprang into three dimensions, permanent and ineradicable, the things that had life in them instead of death. The sky was a wonder to him then, the immense blackness and the lustrous stars, on a night when his parents took him out to a neighbor's after dark, put him to sleep in a strange bedroom, and out of his sleep pulled him, lost and groping and clinging to slumber, to load him into the buggy. There, cradled in his mother's lap, he opened his eyes fully and saw the wonder, the black roof, with the glory streaming through its rents, and the miracle of a night sky would always be with him. There would never be another night of his life when the sight of the stars would not have in it some of that first awe and wonder, when his jaded perception would not borrow freshness from that original bright image in the eyes of a star-gazing child. That was one. That was one of many. They were not all visual images, he discovered, sorting them out. There were smells and sounds and old tunes sung over and over until they gathered to themselves all the associations of the places and times in which they had been sung. His mother's snoring breath went up catchily, grating in the sick lungs to its tremulous climax, paused, came out in the windy sigh. Bruce shut his mind on it, turned away, fled, just as he had lain still and pretended to sleep as a child, when the windstorms blew the slatted curtains, and tubs and buckets began tumbling in the homestead yard. He had lain snug and warm, hearing the padding of feet and his father's grumbling, and he had known he should get up to help. But the sheets were warm, the bed was comfortable, sleep lay just around the corner where he had left it. There was the smell of hot choke-cherry patches, hillsides hot under the sun, and spice and bark and leaf mold, and the fruity odor of the berries, and the puckery alum tang of a ripe cluster stripped into the mouth, the feel of the pits against the palate, the free and wild and windy feeling of late summer on the bench hills, and the odor of the berry patch through it like a theme. It was an odor that he had never quite found again, though dozens of times in the canyons, on sunny streets, under the lines of Lombardy poplars, in warehouses, in stores, he had stopped, sniffing, his nose assailed by a tantalizing fragrance that was almost it, but not quite. That smell, or its ghost, could bring him out of reverie, or talk, or concentration deep as a well, and leave him for a moment free from time, eager and alive and excited, in search of an odor that was more than a memory, that was a permanent reality. And the songs. The bugle song on the bank of the coulee among the early summer blossoming of primrose and cactus and buttercup, with the ghostly mountains far down across the heat-scorched plain. The song that had always meant, and meant now, all romantic yearning, all nostalgia for the never-never and the wonderful, that still, in spite of all he had learned since, could have an instant effect on him, choke him up, clog his tear ducts, make him, driving alone on an open road, singing to himself, wipe his hand across his eyes and laugh with self-conscious shame. A childhood hunter, a searcher for old forgotten, far-off things and battles long ago, a maunderer. He knew it. Yet the words of life were in those songs, and those smells, and the green dreams of childhood. In his life there had been the death of too many things. He shifted in the bed, realizing that not anything he had been thinking of had cut off the sound of his mother's breathing. "Oh, Christ," he said. "I wish—" He sat up. The light had gone on in the bedroom, and the breathing was broken. In three steps he was through the door, the fear like a hand clenched in his shirt. His mother lay moving her head weakly from side to side, her forehead puckered, her face and neck wet.
"Will you turn on the light?" she said.
He stared at her. She was looking straight up into the brightness of the lamp. "Sure," he said from a dry mouth. "I should have put a string on that switch." He rattled the metal pull of the lamp.
"Better?"
She did not answer directly, but moved her hand toward the water glass. The bewildered look was fading from her face. He helped her take a sip of water, wiped her face with a towel, turned her pillow. When Miss Hammond appeared in the doorway, he told her to go and lie down again. He would sit up a while. It was still early. His mother lay back, the light stark on her sunken cheeks and wet skin.
"It was so dark," she said fuzzily. "I thought everyone had gone."
"Try to go back to sleep," he said. "I'll sit here with you a while." Her fingers found his and clung, and with her hand alternately clenching and relaxing on his, she appeared to doze. The agonized fight for breath went on. After a few minutes, he pulled off the light. The neon blue fluttered for a moment through the Venetian blinds, steadied to a pale, laddered glimmer. The tires of passing cars whispered and hissed in the rainy street.
"This is it," Bruce said, sitting still, sitting quietly,
unwilling to shift his cramped body for fear of disturbing her.
"Any breath may be her last one."
He bent his head on his hand and let himself slump, tired, ready to fall asleep, but fighting sleep and hating his tiredness because they were treachery, because she was dying now, tonight. At any minute the worn heart might go, the breathing shiver to a stop. He listened to the breaths, up and up and up, painfully, and the wheezy escape of the hard-won air. Miss Hammond came out on tiptoe and laid a sweater across his shoulders, and he pulled it around him, aware that it was chilly. The traffic was less on the street, but the neon light drifted in steadily, like vague blue smoke, a slight tremor in the shadowy room. He heard the courthouse clock strike 11, then 12. The breathing faltered, strengthened, slowed, went on. "The vitality," he said, "is lowest during the early morning hours. If she lived past 3, she might last another day, stubbornly clinging to the life she had already given up." He found himself hoping that she would die now, and the imminence of the thing he had been watching and fearing for weeks made him move cautiously, straighten his slumped and aching back, thrust one chilled hand into his pocket. His mother moved. Her fingers tightened, and her voice, flat and muffled, said,
"You're a good boy, Bruce."
He sat thinking of that, thinking of the times for years back when he had been selfish or thoughtless, of the girls he had chased and dated 4 or 5 nights a week, never remembering that his mother might be alone, that the old man went off to prowl with his friends or deliver whiskey, leaving her in an empty house. He remembered the few times he had taken her anywhere, to movies, for drives in the canyons, to dinner, and those times seemed so pitifully few and mean that he writhed.
"You're a good boy, Bruce."
"Yes," he said, 20 years too late and overpaid in advance, 50 times in advance, and now paid with gratitude on her deathbed.
"Oh, Jesus," he said, "let her die."
The clock, heavy and solemn over the sleeping city, gathered itself and struck once. The sound aroused the sick woman. She struggled up on one elbow, her hand hard on Bruce's fingers. Her head turned to the right, then to the left.
"Which way?"
she said. "It's all right, Mom," he said, and pushed her gently back, pulling the covers to her chin. She lay still, immediately back in the drugged coma, and he sat on in the straight chair, listening to her fighting, impossible breath, holding his own breath when the snore labored to its peak, relaxing again when it was released, counting her breaths almost, because at any point in the difficult scale her heart might quit like a tired horse in the harness. "The vitality is lowest during the early morning hours." 1:15 or thereabouts, and the minutes crawling, and his mother retreating breath by breath.
"Which way?"
His nodding head jerked up. The had stopped, snagged at the top of the scale. The long pause between inhalation and exhalation was slow, was too long. He yanked on the light. "Miss Hammond!"
She came instantly, it seemed, was shoving him away from the bedside. In the shouting, silence, he saw her seize his mother's shoulders, put a finger in her mouth, jerk it out again to grab a spoon from the table, and with the handle pry against his mother's tongue, pulling it back out of her throat. The legs under the covers moved slightly, the clogged breath gave easily, in three little sighs, and he was staring into the sick face of Miss Hammond, the spoon in her hand free now, and his mother's eyes closing very slowly. He saw the tears come into Miss Hammond's eyes as she groped without looking to lay the spoon on the table. The covers were disarranged over his mother's body, and the nightgown was pulled aside. He saw her breast, the unmutilated one, like a lumpy, mummified thing, the nipple retracted, pulled in as if by a terrific suction, and the skin blue-black and withered over her whole side.
"Oh, my God!" Miss Hammond was saying. "Oh, my God!"
He turned, blind and terrified, and fled. Chapter 4 When he came in again, the light was on in both front room and porch. Miss Hammond looked up quickly. He could not meet her eyes for more than an instant, because behind her was the lighted porch, and his mind went around that door and stopped at the foot of the bed. Instead of going in, he went to the telephone and called long distance, waiting with the blank wall before his eyes and the receiver against his ear, fixing his mind on the efficient buzzings, the unknown voices speaking crisply, the long, regular, unmusical ringing on the other end. Death traveled fast. In 3 minutes, he could spread death. He waited, the receiver humming at his head. What would the old man say? Would he pretend grief, he with his cowardice and his kept slut? Maybe she was with him. That would make it just dandy. She could ride back with him, consoling him all the— Hello, he said, breaking in on the voice at the other end. It was a man's voice, probably Patton's. Hello, he said. This is Bruce Mason. Is my father there?
"Yeah,"
the voice said surlily, and then quickly, as if remembering,
"Yeah, sure. Hold it just a minute."
He waited again. Through the open line he could hear steps coming. He looked straight at the yellow wall, his tongue like an unbendable rod in his mouth.
"Hello?"
his father's quick voice said.
"Hello, Bruce? What is it?
There was a rattling noise, and then his father's voice again, quick and anxious.
"Hello? Drop the damn phone. What's the matter?"
"She's dead," Bruce said. 2 hours ago. I thought you'd want to know." There was no answer for so long that he dropped his lips to the mouthpiece to say, "Hello? Hello?" But as he did so, he heard the sigh of his father's breath, distorted and rasping over the wire, and then his voice, quiet, almost a whisper.
"Yeah. I'll be right home."
"All right," Bruce said. "I'll make the arrangements." There was another pause, only a kind of panting coming through the receiver.
"Was it bad?" his father said. Was she in pain?"
Bruce raised his head. On impulse, out of pure contempt, he lied. "No," he said. "She just went to sleep." The nurse moved aside, and he stepped past her into the porch. His mother lay with the sheet up to her chin. Her hands, folded on her stomach, made a little draped mound under the sheet. Her hair had been dried and rebraided, and her face was wiped clean of any expression, even the lines rubbed away as an artist might erase lines from a sketch. It was a younger face that lay there, a face completely calm, a prettier face, actually, than he had known. But it was not his mother. His mother had been wiped away with the lines that living had left on her. She was the shading, not the face itself. In this wax image there was none of her patience, none of her understanding and sympathy, none of her kindness, none of her dignity. This corpse was a thing you could bury without regret,
put into the ground beside your brother's body. And the other things, the qualities that had been mystically your mother, you buried within yourself. You became a grave for her, as you were a grave for Chet, and you carried your dead unquietly within you. On the evening of the next day, he sat reading in the deserted apartment. He had gone grimly through his duties, half grateful for something to do, half appreciating why the race made a ritual of death. He had bought a casket, feeling that if he left that to his father would throw away hundreds of dollars in a useless sacrifice to his own shame and fear. He had talked to Cullen, signed the death certificate, gone to the cemetery and seen the sexton about the grave lot next to Chet's. After dinner, he had said goodbye to Miss Hammond. Tomorrow, probably around noon, his father should be back. The funeral was set for 3. If the old man was late, that was his bad luck. He could be shown where she was buried. That would be all he deserved. He looked at the clock on the end table by the sofa. 10:15. He might go to bed, but he knew he couldn't sleep, even though he was exhausted. He moved the light closer and opened the book again. At 11:30, he stopped reading to listen. Someone was fumbling at the door. He stood up just as his father opened the door and came in. And in the silent apartment, with the fact of death between them, they confronted each other. His father's face was like a dirty dough mask. The unhealthy bags under his eyes had swollen and darkened. His cheeks sagged. His eyes were furtive and haunted. For a moment he stood with his hand on the knob, moistening his lips with his tongue. "You got back quick," Bruce said. "Aye." The old man closed the door and took a step or two into the room. His eyes darted past Bruce toward the door of the porch. Without the door to hang to, he staggered a little and put his hand down on the arm of the sofa, lowering himself into it heavily. "I got lost," he said. His lips moved in the parody of a smile, and his eyes went secretly past Bruce toward the porch door again. "You couldn't have stayed lost very long. I wasn't expecting you till tomorrow." "I don't know what was the matter," his father said, rubbing his hand back and forth on the arm of the couch. "I was dazed, I guess. I've been over that road 100 times." He shook his head. "I left right after you called." Bruce watched him, wondering if he were quite right in the head. He must have driven like a madman. "Down around Yermo somewhere," his father said. "I got out on some godforsaken road with sand to the running boards. Just ran around in circles in the desert. Didn't know where I was. Dazed, I guess." He took out his watch, looked at it, turned it over in his hand 2 or 3 times, put it back in his pocket. His eyes came up to Bruce fleetingly, wavered away again. "I'll get you something to eat," Bruce said. He wondered how long they would play this game of steering away from mentioning her death. The old man came back from a trip, and they passed banalities back and forth and had a snack to eat. In the kitchen, he almost smiled. The old man was out again, like a bum who has been thrown out of jail and stands with the bars in his hands, wishing he was back in the warmth and light, getting 3 meals a day.
"What time did she pass away?" his father said behind him.
Even that, Bruce thought, even pass away. But there was such a strained, harsh quality in the old man's voice that he turned around. The watch was in his father's hand again. "A little after 1, Bruce said, "about 1:15. He saw the spasm cross the dark, heavy face, the harsh lines contracting as if at a sudden pain.
"That was 12:15 in L.A., the old man said.
He turned the watch over slowly in his hand, looked at the face. He looked back at Bruce, swaying a little, breathing rapidly through his half-open mouth.
"Look," he said,
and passed over the watch with its dangling chain.
The watch said 12:14.
I was in bed, the old man said, and his tongue came out to touch his upper lip. I heard it stop. I thought it needed winding, but it didn't. It wouldn't start again.
The blank terror in his eyes made Bruce look away, down at the watch. He shook it, held it to his ear.
That won't do any good, his father said. I tried everything.
His face contorted again, twisted, softened. He sat down on a kitchen chair and put his face in his hands, and his body shook. After a minute, unwillingly, not knowing exactly why he did it, Bruce laid a hand on the wide, shaking shoulder.
It's no good now, he said. We just have to stand it.
That was all he could think of to say. He did not believe in his father's grief. It was not grief, but self-pity and superstitious fear. With his hand on the heavy shoulder, troubled and embarrassed, he kept thinking, "You might have given her a little of this while she was alive." Chapter 5 Beau Mason could not stand to stay in the place Elsa had died in. The door of the porch seemed to bother him. His eyes were always wandering to it with the vague, groping, puzzled expression that was now very frequent on his face. Every night he had nightmares, and on the fourth day they moved across the street. Bruce, shrugging, carried their little household accumulation across. This move was all of a piece with the rest. The old man couldn't bear to think of her dead, pitied himself for being left, couldn't bring himself to mention her except in roundabout euphemisms like passing away, and now couldn't stand to be near the room she had died in. It made little difference to Bruce. In January, if he got back the scholarship he had written about, he would be pulling out for school again, and he would not be coming back. He felt so little established in that barren apartment that he didn't even unpack his suitcases completely, but left them propped open on chairs in the bedroom. And this was what it finally came to. For 30 years his mother had tried to break the old man to family life, had wanted to make something rooted and continuous that would bridge the dissonant generations. And in the end, with her death, it came down to an apartment in which he and his father, the survivors, lived together in perpetual armed suspicion, with half-packed suitcases in the bedroom, ready for instant flight. He got a few jobs through friends at the university, typing theses and reading papers, and the money from those jobs he hoarded like a miser. There would be little enough to live on once he broke away, and he would ask nothing from the old man. Meantime, if he was keeping the house, he was entitled to anything he could save out of the expense money. He pinched nickels and dimes like a housewife hoarding for Christmas, spent little, and went out little. In the time he had free from his jobs, he sat in the apartment and read with lunch, read with dinner, read in bed, woke to read with breakfast. His friends he never called, even Joe Mulder. They would have tried to take him out and cheer him up. When he saw his father watching him, he made no sign, buried himself in a book, until the old man put on his new black hat and went out. For whole days sometimes there were not 20 words between them. October slipped into the shortening, smoky days of November, and the color faded from the scarp of the Wasatch. In the afternoons the sun hung like a monstrous orange over the ochres, and the night air was bitter with smoke. On one such night, Beau Mason tried to blunder through the barrier of suspicion that lay between him and his son. He had come home for dinner, which was unusual, and after dinner, instead of going out again, he sat in the living room looking at a magazine. Every few minutes he looked over as if inviting conversation, but Bruce kept still. Finally, his father said, slapping the magazine down on his lap,
"By God, I don't see what a man can do."
"What's the trouble?" Bruce said.
"Everything's the trouble," the old man said. "Nobody's got a dime. There's no business. The place is dead as a doornail. There isn't a damn thing stirring, not a thing."
Haven't you got enough from the sale in Reno to hold you till things pick up?
That wouldn't last, the old man said.
I've only got 6,000 out of that so far. The rest is tied up in notes. And with nothing coming in, you can't live on the interest on a few thousand.
Bruce shrugged.
I've been talking with some guys down at the new house, his father said. They've got a proposition they want me to come in on.
Something stirred in Bruce like a quick wind moving the leaves and then dying again. The old man was repeating the performance he had gone through with his wife every time a new bug hit him, asking advice, coming around and hinting and opening it up little by little. Only it wasn't advice he wanted. It was justification, encouragement.
What sort of proposition? Bruce said.
For a moment his father's eyes were quick and clear, the vague look gone from them.
A mine, he said. Looks like a pretty good thing.
A lot of mines look like pretty good things, Bruce said. Only when you take a good look, you find that the good things have been blown into them with a shotgun.
All right, his father said. You know it all.
I don't know anything about it, Bruce said.
He felt himself flushing, and for a moment their dislike was hard and ugly, in the open.
I'd just be suspicious of any mining deal on principle. The Utah Copper and the International and the Apex and all the other big mines have got every prospect in the state tagged. Just waiting till it will pay them to open them up.
This mine, his father said, isn't even in Utah. It's in Nevada. And it's got gold enough in it to be damn well worth looking at.
Then look at it, Bruce said. I wasn't trying to knock it. I'm just suspicious of any kind of scheme that's going to make you rich overnight.
His father said. The groping look had come back, and two little dewlaps of skin sagged below his jaw. He fumbled in his inside coat pocket and brought out a bundle of papers.
This is a fairly low-grade lead, he said. It'd take money to develop it. Need a stamp mill and one thing and another, but it's a big lead, a vein 20 feet wide. We can get this fellow's claim and options on 4 claims joining it.
Have you had an assay?
4 ounces of gold to the ton, the old man said. Some silver, some lead.
How do you know the samples came out of that hole?
Paul Dubois has been down looking it over. He knows a sound mine when he sees one.
What do they want of you?
Want me to come in for a third. We could put up 3,000 or 4,000 apiece, enough for some development. Then we incorporate and capitalize for 100,000 or so, sell enough stock to put in the mill. Once it gets producing, we can either work it ourselves or sell out for a fat price to some big outfit.
Make $1,000,000, Bruce said. He laughed.
I'd sure want to take a good geologist down with me before I dove in a hole like that. And I'd want to know about water and transportation and a lot of other things.
There isn't time for much of that, his father said. Hartford Consolidated is snooping around. They had a prospector out there last month, and there's a tunnel going in on the other side of the hill, about 3 miles off. If we want to get the jump, we've got to move fast.
When Bruce sat looking at him silently, the old man's brows drew down and his face darkened.
I suppose you'd say it was dangerous.
When somebody wants you to jump quick, Bruce said, there's a good chance there's something fishy.
But it's your funeral.
Have you got 3,000 or 4,000?
I'm not so hard up I couldn't raise 3,000, his father said. I could sell some stock. The damn stuff's never going to come up again anyway. I've still got some Firestone and some U.S. steel.
Suit yourself, Bruce said. I'm no gambler, and I don't know beans about mines.
The old man put the papers back into his pocket. Bruce had never made a move to look at them.
Well, we'll see, his father said.
He was wearing the black tie he had bought for the funeral, and there was a stain on it. Picking up his hat, he started for the door.
I may be out pretty late, he said.
The door closed, and Bruce sat, thinking. If the old man started playing the Wildcat Mines, he'd be cleaned in a year. He was not a good gambler. He was careful and suspicious to a point, and then he opened up like a grain chute in an elevator. Anybody who got past his first caution could pump him like a well.
And I don't give a damn if they do,
he said, remembering the miserly unwillingness of his father to get a nurse. He tightened his lips across his teeth. Not so hard up he couldn't raise 3,000. And now, mourning, he said, now it's a black felt hat and a black tie and an armband, probably, if you could get anybody to sew one on him. Oh, yes, he said, sitting furiously with his hands tight on the book. You can't come back and accuse me of anything. I wear black to commemorate my bereavement. I have put the cross above my door and tossed the salt over my left shoulder and spun 3 times round and said the words. My dead can't touch me. I have fulfilled the forms, buried the body deep in the ground, spread flowers on the earth, paid the sexton for perpetual care of the grave lot, and I have bought a new black hat and a black tie. I hope, he said to the barren walls of the apartment, they roll him for everything he's got and leave him stranded in the gutter without car fare to the poorhouse. In the last week of November, when the leaves were pulpy in the gutters and piled high on the curbings, waiting for the trash trucks, Bruce borrowed a shotgun and went duck shooting up on Bear River Bay with a car full of friends. For just that one day, in spite of cold and chilblains and a raw, wet wind, he felt liberated and happy. It was so much positive joy to crouch uncomfortably in the blind waiting for the swift flights to come over, listening to the sodden boom of an automatic up the marshes. So much fun to leap upright in the tules and slap the padded butt to his shoulder, follow the speeding ducks with the muzzle, lead them a little, let go and be thumped by the recoil. It was so much fun to see a racing long-necked duck fold suddenly and fall like a stone that he wondered at himself. Why should it be fun to kill ducks? What possible joy was it to spread death when you had yourself lived with death too much and hated the very word? But he could not deny that it gave him a hot, bright pleasure. Maybe it was just the fun of knowing you were a fairly decent shot. The ducks were scared and flew fast. Not everybody could hit a target the size of a saucepan moving 60 miles an hour. And that was something he had learned from his old man. At least in the business of killing, his instruction had been good. But even that reflection couldn't spoil the fun of being outdoors, getting the wind on him, seeing the brown tules emerge from the mist and the gray channels of water open up as the light grew. He thought of Chet, lost and miserable, the heart taken out of him, his health shot, trying to learn taxidermy in the last months of his life, going out in his off hours to the salt marshes and shooting small birds, fussing with them on the bench in the basement, working in patient protective abstraction with wadding and glue and pins, the mail-order taxidermy book open beside the crows and magpies and snipe he had brought home. Chet had always loved to hunt. For an instant, in the cold circle of tules under the sky like cold lead, he felt naked and alone and scared, and he would have given anything to have Chet there with him, just for an hour, just to say hello, just to lend him the gun for a shot or two. Chet had been too soft. Not soft like his mother, but weak. His mother, soft and gentle as she was, had beaten the old man in a way. It was he who ran at the last minute. Because she knew how to renounce without giving up herself. She could win just by being herself in spite of everything. Chet couldn't. There was enough of the old man in him to spoil him, enough of his mother to soften him, not enough of either to save him. "What about you?" he said. "What have you got?" But he knew without asking. He had got enough of the old man's hardness to armor him. He was as hard as his father, harder. The old man could still bluster, but he wasn't what he used to be. He was whipped, and he knew it. His wife had whipped him, without ever meaning to and without realizing it, and his one remaining son was going to whip him further. It was a curious thing that once he got away from Salt Lake for a day, he could see how, in a way, his mother's life, which had shut her off from everything she wanted to have, had forced her to become what she wanted to be. The older she grew, the richer she became in herself, and the older and more affluent the old man became, the more he deteriorated. He lost friends where she gained them. He weakened as she grew stronger. He lowered himself year by year. Going home after dark that night, his chilled feet aching with a hard, constricting pain, he leaned back in the seat contentedly, thinking of that day only a month or so away now, when he could pull out for good. The $34 he had put away would get him there. Once there, he could make out somehow. There was always some way you could make it, something you could do to live if you wanted to live. You could wash dishes, scrub floors, fire furnaces, wait table, do something. You could renounce everything but the essentials, and the essentials included only a minimum to eat and wear. He was asleep when they reached Salt Lake, and awoke only when the car pulled up in front of a drugstore on 3rd South and State, while Joe went in for some cigarettes. Bruce stretched, yawned, moved the pile of ducks a little with his aching feet. He looked out at the crowds coming from the movies, swarming into the drug for a snack. The clock on the Sears Roebuck store said 10:15. He yawned again. He shut his mouth so sharply against the yawn that it hurt his jaw. His father was coming down State Street, strolling, and with him was a woman holding the leash on an ugly Boston bull. The pup's wide chest was clothed in a red and blue sweater, and his legs strained as he surged against the thong. "So that," Bruce thought, "is what he's been keeping." He watched her, youngish, early 30s probably, hennaed, small, well-made, mounted on heels 4 inches high, her legs and ankles the kind of legs and ankles he had seen on dozens of women of her kind, small-boned and rounded, the calf muscles bunching a little as she walked. That was what the old man picked when he wanted a woman. With a quarter of a century of a good woman behind him, he could pick up a sleazy little chippy like that. He watched her pull together the collar of her black fur coat, laughing a little as the dog pulled her off balance. Then he slouched down in the seat for fear his father would glance sideways and recognize him in the parked car. That night he fell into bed after a hot bath, too tired for anger, and weary of anger anyway, sick for the time when he could leave. There was his own life to live, and none of it lay here anymore. In the morning he looked into the other bedroom. Either his father had not come home, or was already gone. The kitchen table was still cluttered with dirty dishes. A piece of kippered salmon had been left out of the refrigerator and was curling on a plate. A half-bottle of milk stood out. Sourly, he washed up before getting his own breakfast, and after breakfast he started sweeping up the other rooms. On the end table in the living room, he found the letter left out for him. It was from Minnesota, and it said that no scholarships were available at the mid-year. If he chose to come on, some work could perhaps be found for him, and in view of his record of the past year, Dr. Aswell had offered to take him on as an assistant. That would pay $200 for the semester. Other things would perhaps turn up if he were on the ground. He rattled the letter and read it again, lifted his head to look out into the bare branches of the hickories. It was not as good as he had hoped for, but it was good enough. In a pinch, he could almost live on $200 for the semester. "Heidi-ho," he said. He was loose. He was free. He might even leave a little early and stay with Kristen for a few days before school opened. In a month, at most, he could shed the whole dead weight of the past and start over. He felt too good to read. His fingers itching to pack, he estimated the cleaning bill he would have to run up in order to leave with his clothes in shape, calculated the date he would have to send the laundry so as to get it back the day before he left. And in the middle of those calculations, he thought of his mother's clothes. He hadn't had the heart to go through them and sort them out, lay aside a pile for the Salvation Army, give her better things to her friends. It was stupid to keep them in the closet till the moths destroyed them.
That was the sort of sentimental, useless gesture his father might make.
He went to the hall closet and opened the door, but the instant emanation, the something of his mother that emerged, made him pause. He put out his hand and touched a house dress, neatly starched and pressed, left that to finger the silk of what had once been her best dress. She was in these clothes somehow. She was in them as she had not been in the body the undertakers wheeled out that night. These were things her taste had selected. Her spirit, as well as her body, had worn them, and they had in them something of her plainness, something of her simple dignity. It was hard to destroy this, too, to give away every fragrant remnant of what she had been. But there was her fur coat. There were two or three good dresses, some shoes, a good many things that some of her friends would appreciate and use. It was only decent to divide her among people who had liked and respected her. The coat, for instance, could be sent to Laura, who had moved to California. He rattled the hangers down the rod, frowned, slipped them back one by one, looking. Then he lifted the clothes back to see the hooks on the wall. The fur coat was not there, though he had put it there himself only a couple of weeks ago. For a second he stood furious and incredulous. He yanked the hangers sideways, thumbing through them with shaking hands. The best dress was gone, the black velvet. Two pairs of the best shoes were gone. There was no sign of the quilted bed jacket he had given her on her birthday. And that slut on the corner last night had been wearing a black fur coat, seal with a squirrel collar, and it was only the best things, the new things, that were missing. The closet swam in a red mist. He was shaking so hard that he had to feel his way out, and when he found a chair and sat down on it, he hung onto it with both hands. The red mist lay over the whole room. His sight was bloody with it. In that moment, if his father had been in the room, he would have tried to kill him, and he knew it, even if he wasn't in the room. He jumped up and rummaged through his father's dresser, found the .38 that the old man carried on trips, broke the cylinder and found it loaded in five chambers, the hammer down carefully on the empty sixth. It was a heavy, solid satisfaction to his palm. It was iron, and it was murderous. Putting on his coat, he slipped the gun into the side pocket and went out, and all the way down the hall and stairs and into the hazy brightness of the morning street, he moved with his jaw locked like a trap and a singular quietness in his muscles, as if he waited for something. The red smear of mist was still before his eyes. He started walking up West Temple toward town, heading for the New Grand Hotel where his father sometimes hung out. His hand was in his coat pocket, holding the sag of the gun. "After all these years," he said, "after 20 years of hating him." He noticed that the morning was fine. The smoky air lay over him, soft as feathers. The sunlight was diffused and mellow. Trucks were working down the street, picking up heaps of leaves, still sodden from the rains. His eyes were very sharp. Things fixed themselves on his senses. He had a curious feeling that his mind was a steel plate, a mirror which reflected impressions without absorbing them. Quick tears stung his eyes as suddenly as if he had had acid flung in his face, and he bent his head, still walking, still with his fingers curled under the weight of the .38. Ahead of him was the hotel, and he closed his fingers hard around the gun. "Now," his mind said, "if he's there..." His body was curiously light, a steel framework, as if he were not solid, as if he were invisible, and he did not hear his own steps on the tile floor as he crossed the lobby to the desk. "I'm looking for my father," he said to the clerk, "Harry Mason." "Yeah," the clerk said. He stood up and looked up and down the lobby. "He was in here a while ago. Seems to me I saw him just a few minutes back." He beckoned a bellhop. "Seen Harry Mason around?" "Not for a while," the bellhop said. "He was sitting over by the windows for a while, talking to a woman. Then a couple guys come in. I guess they all went out together." "Thanks," Bruce said. "I'll look somewhere else." He went across the open lobby again, and as he turned sideways to avoid a man coming in the door, he saw the clerk and bellhop watching him. He took his hand out of his pocket, put it back again because the gun showed through the cloth. On the street he hesitated, his mind carefully numb to everything except the simple question of where his father might be. As if he were bearing a message, as if he had no personal interest in his father, but had to find him for someone else, he went up a block and pushed open the door of the cigar store. Two men were leaning against the counter, but his father was not there. He looked toward the back room, but the door was half closed, and he could see nothing. The man behind the counter recognized him and spoke.
"Looking for your dad?"
"Yeah."
"I think he's gone out of town. He was in this morning. Said something about going to Nevada to look at a mine."
"Oh," Bruce said. An instant sickness, a feeling as if he might faint, made him put his hand on the counter. "Well, thanks," he said, and turned away.
"Anything wrong?"
the clerk said.
"No."
So it would have to wait. On the sidewalk again, breathing deeply, he felt his body come back to him, heavily, a tired weight of flesh. He took his sweating hand off the gun and rubbed it on his coat, and without much thought of why he went, he turned back toward home. In the apartment he sat down and looked fixedly at the half-filled bookcase. Somebody would have to take those books back to the library. He imagined the landlord coming in sourly, looking around the place, wondering what to do first in this apartment, what to do with the property of the dead man and his jailed son, picking up a book and seeing the library stamp on it, laying out a stack to send back, looking into the closets, shaking his head at the burdens people laid on him. "This is the end of that," Bruce said. "They will hang a considerable amount of reading when they hang me." He took the gun out and laid it on the table. Beyond him, the open closet door yawned, and with petulant haste, he got up to slam it shut. For some time he sat looking at the gun, the blued steel, the brown wooden butt gracefully and powerfully arched.
"I thank you," he said, "for teaching me to shoot."
But he felt the closet door behind him, and he broke a cigarette, taking it from the pack. Everything material that was left of his mother was in the closet, and he heard it talking to him.
"I held no grudge," it said. "Why should you? Your father was lonely, lonelier even than you, probably, because he's old and you're young. He had to have a woman to lean on and to reassure him that he was a man and strong. And the clothes were no good to me. They might as well have been given to someone."
"But my God," he said aloud, "to that slut!"
"You don't know," the closet behind him said. "You never met her. Maybe she's good for him, better than I was."
He picked up the gun and went into his bedroom. His suitcases sat open on their chairs. There was all that, the whole life he had planned for himself, the studies he wanted to finish, the career he wanted. Did you blow things like that? Blow your mother's faith and pride in you? Blow every chance you had to live down your old man's life and make something useful of yourself just for the pleasure of ridding the earth of him? He went into his father's room slowly and put the gun back in the drawer. He knew he couldn't do it now. He had known it, actually, from the time of that momentary sickness in the cigar store. If he could have done it in a rage, it would be done now. But the minute he started thinking about it, it was impossible. Back in his own room again, he began frantically throwing clothes into the suitcases, dirty ones and clean ones together, shirts and socks and handkerchiefs and pajamas jammed in with shoes and laundry, cramming them in as if he had only minutes to catch a train. He was still cleaning the dresser drawers when he heard the front door open. In the flash of returning rage, he wished for the gun. He saw his father in the red haze, framed by the door, and he saw himself shooting him down, felt the hard, jumping kick of the gun in his wrist, saw the heavy, black-hatted figure stagger and slump, one hand hanging to the jamb. He turned and went on with his packing, and from the living room heard his father's voice.
"How was the hunting?"
"Fair," he said, without turning. "I got 7.
"Ha," his father said. "A duck feed. I haven't had a duck feed for 2-3 years.
"I gave 3 to the fellow I borrowed the gun from," Bruce said, "and 2 to the boy who loaned me the boots. There's 2 in the icebox."
"You can't have a duck feed on 2 ducks," his father said. "What did you give them all away for?"
"To pay my debts," Bruce said. The old man came into the bedroom behind him.
"Packing up?" he said. "Where are you going?"
"I'm pulling out for Minneapolis," Bruce said, turning. His father was staring at him with quick, prying eyes, the little dewlaps of skin below his jowls giving him a pugnacious bulldog look.
"I thought school didn't start till the middle of January or so."
"It doesn't. I'll go visit Kristen."
"You make up your mind pretty sudden, don't you?"
"I got a letter," Bruce said. "They'll give me a little job. There's nothing to stick around here for." Standing with one hand on the lid of the suitcase, he set himself. In a minute he wouldn't be able to do this patter chorus any longer, and then they would be out in the open. There was a light trembling in his legs, and his face was stiff.
"No," his father said after a pause, "I guess not."
He wandered to the dresser, fingered the corner of a pile of handkerchiefs. He turned around.
"Need any money?"
Bruce's lips flattened against his teeth.
"Not from you," he said.
Now they were looking at each other as they had wanted to look for 20 years without either of them daring. The trembling came up inside him, came up and outward, and he clenched his hands to keep them steady. He saw the dark face before him go darker.
"What the hell is eating you?" his father said. "Nobody's been holding you here."
"Nobody could," Bruce said. He saw the symptoms of his father's quick and growing anger, the old, old symptoms remembered from his cradle, it seemed to him, the way his head wagged back and forth, the way his teeth came together, the way he snorted through his nose and his eyes got hard and boring. "I'll tell you what's eating me," he said, and it was as if he were sitting on his voice, holding it down. "It's the same thing that's been eating me ever since I was old enough to walk. You've never been a decent father to me."
"What?" the old man said. "What are you talking about?"
He was in a shaking rage, but Bruce's voice, coming like a sharp, thin blade, cut him off, stabbed him with the accumulated grievances of his whole life.
"You never were a decent father to Chet," he said. "You broke him before he ever had a chance to get started. You never were a decent husband to Mother."
Both his father's hands were over his head.
"Shut up!"
he shouted. His whole head shook, and his hands came down in a pounding gesture.
"Shut up! What in Christ's name are you saying?"
The abrupt, wide-shouldered lurch with which he swung away said that he was not going to stand and listen to any more damned nonsense, but in an instant he had pivoted, as if in a dance step, and came back. His voice was a harsh rattle.
"How haven't I been a decent father? How did I break Chet?"
"You cowed us both from the time we were out of diapers," Bruce said, the shaking like an ecstasy inside him. "You bullied and stormed and never tried to understand that you were dealing with children. You kept on running whiskey when you knew all of us hated it and suffered for it. You made Chet ashamed in front of his friends, and you chased him into finding friends he didn't need to be ashamed in front of. You led Mother a dog's life all the time she was married to you." The rage had disappeared from his father's face, and he looked tired, weak, flabby.
"You too, I suppose," he said.
"I went through college being ashamed of you," Bruce said, "lying about you on questionnaires and registration forms. Father's profession, rancher, cattle buyer, veterinary. Other people could respect their fathers. I couldn't. All I could do was..." His father's voice was so like a groan that he stopped, out of breath and panting. The old man's face twisted, the loose flesh puckered in a wild grimace.
"Oh, Jesus God," he said. "I had to make a living, didn't I? I had to support you, didn't I? You lived on me all the time you were having such troubles being ashamed of me, didn't you?"
"I paid my own tuition and most of my expenses.